Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And welcome to this week's episode. Things have been pretty intense. I know I've stopped posting quite so much on the Facebook and not really getting a lot of additional stuff out there beyond the fact that I'm doing two episodes a week now. There is kind of a wonderful aspect of this, being able to do it all myself, handling everything, the booking, the flyers, the promotion, the recording, the editing. It's all me, kind of doing it all on my own. And as such, it can get a little stressful. On top of all of that, just doing the various things that people do. I get up, I go to work, I'm in a couple of bands, I got some other projects kicking around, and yeah, it's a lot. My friendships are tough to maintain, but that's something that happens to everybody when you get busy, especially when you get busy as an adult. Things just get harder and harder to maintain. But if they're worth it, you'll put in the effort, and at the end of the day, you'll be exhausted, but satisfied. I mean, if you're exhausted at the end of the day already, and you're like, I just don't feel like doing anything today. I don't want to go out with so-and-so. I feel like maybe just staying in, ordering some takeout instead of going out. Here's my advice. If you're going to be tired anyway, go out. Go out into the world. Take a walk. Meet some friends. If you're going to be tired anyway, be tired having done something. You'll feel a lot better about it. That's my opinion. I could be wrong. I don't know your life. You know what, though? I'd like to. Send me an email. info@coffeeoversuicide.com. Tell me what's up. What's happening with you? I'll tell you what's happening with me. Today on the show, we've got Eric Sims. This is a really fantastic conversation. I've been getting some really amazing people. Part of that, in fact, is due to my relationship with podcastguests.com. Looking for some interesting people to talk to? There are people in just about any demographic that you are looking to have conversations with. And I found a lot of people who are interested in talking about mental health. And Eric Sims is no exception. We get into the dark waters of depression, anxiety, suicide, all of that. And coming out the other side of it, hopefully trying to be better and live better and have a happier life. I'm still struggling with that. It's not an easy thing to be a bipolar suicidal person and still manage to get out there every day and make life happen. But I'm doing my best with it. And so far, so good. Now let's talk to Eric, see how he's doing. Start right out of the gate with how you doing today?
I'm good. It's been it's one of those interesting days. Back to school day, so I have three little kids, so I was getting them all ready to go to school today. Early start and crazy finish.
Yeah, that's the way it goes, and it's probably going to be that way for at least a couple of weeks until things really settle in.
Yeah, I think it'll take them a week or at least 2 or 3 weeks to get kind of in that new habit. So,
So where am I talking to you from?
Yeah, I'm in Tampa, Florida.
Nice.
So, yeah, been out here for probably about 12 to 15 years.
Where are you originally from?
Originally I'm from Dallas, Texas, or the Dallas-Fort Worth area, really.
Nice. So, how do you end up in Florida?
Well, I moved out here back in 06. Make sure I got my years right. Yeah, like 06, I moved out here. My ex-wife was moving out here. I prefer to call her my daughter's mother, really. My daughter's mother. We're friends, so I don't like using that term because it sounds like, you know, it didn't sound as friendly. But she was moving out here at the time, and her company was giving her an opportunity to transfer out. I've been looking to move out of Dallas for a while. It was just not, you know, I've been in my whole life, and I was all jacked up at that point in time in my life, not in a good space. So I thought, well, it's a good excuse for, you know, the geographical relocation program to try to get my head on straight. And I, you know, Tampa seemed to be a nice place, you know, bodies of water close by and lots of sand.
Yeah.
So I figured, you know, what the hell, I'll come out here and do that. So that's what originally drove it. And then we've all been out here since. So
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, tell me a little bit about what kind of kid you were.
Yeah. It depends on who you ask, right?
Yeah.
So I was probably, as a little kid, I was a good little kid.
Yeah.
I was always, I would say, early on, I was one of those kids that would kind of push the limits and get in trouble quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of testing waters and stuff like that. And, you know, in retrospect, I've done a lot of self-evaluations. I realized I was real insecure at an early age. And so I found a way to get attention, was to, you know, kind of be the bad boy.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I championed that cause starting real early. So, you know, I would, you know, get in nothing major. But, you know, as a little kid, you get in trouble, you mouth off, you know, do stuff you're not supposed to do, stuff like that. But all in all, as a small child, I've asked my mom. She said, you were a good kid until you were 12. I was like, you know. It was a good upbringing.
So it all went sideways at 12?
I don't know that it all went sideways at 12. I think that's when, like, some of the behavior became more noticeable. You know, being a teenager, I started acting out more.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, yeah, which is normal for any teenager, but being that I was in the space that I was in, you know, I think it was I think with me, it's always been like an exaggeration of anything else that anybody else was doing, right? Like, I always had to go the extra mile, the next step, be the guy. If everybody was sneaking out, I had to sneak out, you know, three times. If, you know, if everybody had one, I had to have four, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I was always the guy that, I don't know if it was that I sucked at hiding stuff or that I just didn't give a shit, but I was always the one that got caught. So, you know, it was one of those things that I've got a story. I tell myself and my kids this. I was like, I was just one of those guys, like, in high school, I'll never forget. I was at a party with like three, as a street party with like 300 and something people. I said, guess they gave out one ticket. Guess who got it? You know? So, you know,
yeah, that really hits me where I live. I can relate to that real heavy.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was kind of my mode of operating. You know, I kind of found trouble throughout my adolescence.
Where do you think that came from?
I was extremely insecure at a very early age. You know, being a little kid, I didn't understand it.
Yeah,
you know, but I like, I've told people before, one of my first earliest memories was like first day of preschool. And I remember like just being terrified and standing like holding on to my mom's leg. And, you know, for most people, they look at it and say, like, a lot of kids do that. But for me, it was like I had this overwhelming feeling like I didn't fit in. I said, if I were to articulate it as an adult, everybody got to the party before I did. They all figured out who I was and discussed me before I got there, and it all concluded they didn't like me.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, so that was kind of how I felt, you know. It was just like rejection before rejection even happened type stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And that was like little, like 5-6 years old.
Yeah. I don't know if it's odd. I've talked to other people that sometimes it manifests that early, but
yeah.
I mean, like I said, it started then, and then, you know, I would try to do stuff to fit in. I remember, you know, all through my childhood, that was what really led to me getting in trouble. It wasn't that I wanted to get in trouble. It was my way of trying to get people to like me.
Yeah.
And then I figured out, like, if you do certain things, you get attention, and I could control the attention that way. And,
completely.
Yeah. And so that was how I, learned to, kind of create that persona and start protecting myself a little bit early on.
Yeah. It is a form of protection. I mean, you almost dare people to like you.
Exactly. And if they don't, you're like, well, that's the whole thing. Like, it's right. It's a win-win situation. It's really safe. If they don't like me, you're not supposed to.
Yes.
Right? I'm the bad guy. And if you do like me, yeah, you like the bad guy. That's right. Cool. You know? So, it was a great way of protecting from rejection. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, what was your relationship with your parents like at that point?
I don't remember my relationship. So, all through my childhood and high school, I always look back and say I had a great upbringing. I did grow up in a very conservative Christian home, mm-hmm. And I didn't like that. But I think it was mostly just because of the rules, and then being in that Christian community, there was a lot of judgment, you know. At least I perceived there to be a lot of judgment. You know, I don't want to put myself in other people's minds, but I perceived being judged.
Yeah.
And so that created some conflict at times because I didn't fit into the model of what all the other kids were doing. But as far as, like, I always felt like my mom and I still to this day are real close. We talk every day. My dad and I, we had a good relationship. I always felt like, I don't want to say he didn't like me, but we weren't as close. You know, I think right. There was always there was a disconnect there with you and I that lasted, you know, for as long as we had our relationship.
So at some point your relationship with your father splintered off?
No, my dad committed suicide when I was 21. Oh. Right after my 21st birthday. And so, you know, we had just started to kind of patch things up because I had, moved out and was going to school, sort of. I was enrolled in school. But I had a job, I had a sales job. And so there were some things, he was a salesman. And so I think there were some things there that we had in common that, you know, we had started to kind of be able to talk, you know. And I think he was making an effort to connect with me a little bit more too, because I think he realized that there was a disconnect between us there as well. But yeah, he was real close to my brother growing up. My brother's 2.5 years younger than me. So
yeah,
they were real tight. And like I said, it wasn't a bad relationship. It wasn't one of those ones where, like, he told me he didn't like me, or, you know, he beat us or anything like that. He's a great guy. And I knew he loved me. I just always felt like there was just a disconnect in some fashion with he and I.
Yeah. So that happens in your 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's always a real tough one. It doesn't matter what age you are. The loss of a parent is one thing, but the suicide of a parent, I mean, that's quite a lot different, because both of those things, separate from each other, are pretty long lasting and pretty scarring. My wife's mother committed suicide, when we were in our 20s, and that was something that was, it did seem kind of out of left field.
Yeah.
Mostly because you don't ever really know your parents as people. You know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
You kind of know your parents as your parents.
Yep.
So, yeah. I mean, was that something that anybody had any kind of insight on after the fact?
No, I mean, there was a couple, maybe a month or two, and it might have been longer right before, where my mom and a few other people knew he was really, not himself. I'll say he was a super upbeat guy.
Yeah.
And you know, just in my mind, like, you know, even when he died, I think there was like a couple thousand people at his funeral. I mean, it was ridiculous. Like, yeah, everybody liked him. He was one of the nicest, most giving people that I'd ever come. Even to this day, like, when I think of him, it's always in a way of like him just smiling. He had a real cool ability to make people feel good about themselves, and it just the way he's built. And it hit us out of left field. I wasn't expecting. Like I said, other than the last few weeks, we had like a prior, you know, like I'll call it event where, you know, I was not living at home at the time, so I got a call. And my mom's like, you need to come home. And he, I guess, yeah, I knew finances weren't good, you know, at the house. Yeah. There had been some major business issues, and they were struggling and had been for a while. And so I knew he was, like, not himself. But you don't, it never registered in that way. Like, you don't think, like, you know, I'm 21. I don't think, like, oh, yeah, things are going bad. Dad's really struggling. Shit, I hope he doesn't kill himself. Right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, you know. So it's like, oh, then, you know, things are going bad. And he came home, and, you know, I guess he had to talk to my mom and said he had thought about doing something, but he was just depressed. And so they went to the doctor, got antidepressants. I had a long talk with him, you know, at one of the nights before it happened. It was like the last time I ever saw him, which was, you know, like, Pop, you know, Dad, I'll move. I was working. I was like, I'll move home. You know, I can help contribute towards stuff if it's finances. You know, we'll work through this, you know. And that was probably one of the most sincere moments I'd ever had with him personally, from my side of the conversation.
Yeah.
And which, you know, was good because it ended up being the last conversation, not the last conversation, but, well, it was the last conversation we had. It wasn't the last time I ever spoke to him, but it was the last conversation I had with him.
Sure.
And so, it was just, it caught everybody, his friends, family. I mean, if you've been around it, then you know what I'm talking about. It's like, I always describe it as, like, if you take, when you're dealing with suicide, take everybody that a person knows and put them in a circle around that person in a room with the people that know them the best, the closest to them, and then back their way away from that, and then drop a hand grenade right in front of him.
Yeah.
And let it go off. And I said, it hits everybody. Everybody's hurt. Some people more than others. And no one walks away from the situation the same.
Right. Exactly. That I couldn't have put that better. You know, and the other thing that you get about that is that you start finding out that in a lot of cases, different people have different pieces of the puzzle.
Yes.
For who this person was, what their life was like, and you know, the things that they were struggling with, they may not have revealed to everybody.
Yeah, there's a lot of mystery, you know, and you know, you go through the initial shock, right? Like for us, it was the first shock of just like they found the body, the call, my mom, I'll never forget her scream, you know, and me having to hold on to her and my grandfather being there. And then you go through the whole funeral process with everybody coming around, and that, you know, then it kind of calms down. And then, you know, then it gets to the question of like, what's this? And then, I remember this years of questioning. You know, like, just, is he really dead? Did somebody kill him? Was there something else going on? Did somebody steal money from him? Like, you know, you get all this stuff going on. And then different people make different comments, and you don't get full pieces of the story. And you're, like, trying to put everything together, and it doesn't make any damn sense.
Right.
And which just causes further confusion and frustration and, you know, and anger and things like that. So it's just, you know, it's just a big pool of you know, crap.
Yeah, and the longer you start trying to parse out those questions, the longer it's going to take you before you can start moving forward.
Yeah, and that was so that, and you're absolutely correct. And for our situation, you know, for me, I didn't reconcile and get into a place of being okay with it in any capacity until I was 34 years old.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah, it was a long time. I went down a whole different path. My life, you know, went completely sideways, you know, and my brother's had his own path with it, you know, that's been pretty long. And my mom had her own path, and I'm his friends that I've talked to over the years, they dealt with it their way, but it's life altering for everybody involved.
Yeah. Was mental health ever something that was even a discussion in your household growing up?
No, none at all. And my dad's side of the family was real quiet. And I said he talked a lot. And one of the things I talked to some of his buddies, after it passed, some of his closer friends, and one of the things my dad was a master at, that whether it was intentional or not, I don't know, because I never got a chance to ask him, but he was really great at getting you to talk about yourself. And he was really great at making you feel important and making people, feel good. But not very many people knew much about it. He didn't talk about himself very much,
Yeah.
He had one friend that he confided in, and he knew a lot more than probably anybody else. But other than that, like you said, everybody had bits and pieces, and it was just like, nobody knew what was going on. But in our house, nobody had talked about mental health other than right before he did, they put him on some antidepressants, but it wasn't anything. And this was in, 94, 90, like something like that. And so, there wasn't as much awareness around, because the internet thing was, like today, there's a lot of awareness around all this stuff.
Absolutely.
And then a lot of opinions and everything else to go with it. But at that point in time, mental health in my world was still like, oh, that's for people who are really jacked up and crazy. Right.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of, and so, he's not that. So obviously he doesn't need that. And,
yeah.
It was a very ignorant definition of it, but.
Of course. But it was just starting to enter the national conversation at that point. It was something that people really weren't even talking openly about.
Yeah, exactly. And, so we, for us, it was like all news, it was just like, what? And then, we really never got the deal until, probably a couple of years ago, that apparently there had been other members of the family that had struggled with depression heavily, but no one had ever talked about it. So I don't know if my dad even knew it. It was one of my great aunts.
Yeah.
Ended up talking to my mom before she passed and was like, oh yeah, it's, nobody ever wanted to talk about it. So-and-so and so-and-so had problems with it. And, so it was something that was, quote, in the family that just we were unaware of and didn't have any clue of. And then you compile that with an inability to deal with, life on life's terms, and it compiles over years, and, pop goes the weasel.
Yeah. So what does that look like for you? Like as you're trying to learn how to process grief like this, there's a day-to-day that has to happen after a certain point. You got to go back to work. You've got to put your pants on. You've got to take a shower. You've got to shave, and you got to start doing these things whether you feel like it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, what does your day to day look like at that point?
At that point, it was, I held it together. I remember I was trying to hold it together for my mom. Right. Like, so I was like trying to kind of hold things together just to make sure we got through the first little phase of stuff.
Sure.
And then I remember making, like, I was like, I'm just going to stay with her until she's okay. Like, I wasn't going to move out. I wasn't going to do anything. But at the time I thought it was very noble. And looking back, I know it was very codependent and, kind of messed up.
Yeah.
But I had my dad's dad walked in at one point in time, like right the first time I saw him after my dad died, and, he's an old cowboy from Texas, so he didn't have a lot to say. And he was like, I guess you're the head of the family. Take care of things. And I was like,
oh, thanks.
What the fuck does that mean? In my head, I remember thinking like, what the hell does that mean? But
yeah.
I was like, all right, yeah, okay, And so I kind of moved on. I never had a relationship with him very much really after that point. That side of the family pretty much split. That was that phase. And then I was already a very, I was already an alcoholic at that point in time before my dad died. So I had a drinking problem. It was more of a party recreational drinking problem, like an alcohol abuse type thing.
Sure.
But it was still out of control. But at that point in time before my dad died, it was all geared around fun. Like,
yeah.
I just wanted to have a good time. When my dad died, everything changed. And so it got much darker. And I remember like being kind of like, screw everything. Here's a guy who was a deacon in the church, who did everything, quote, the right way, you know, married one woman, took care of her, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, Beaver Cleaver type family setting.
Sure.
And look what it got him. And so I just kind of went the other direction and said, well, I'm going to take whatever I can take. And I don't care who I step on, crush, break, or to go through to get it.
Well, yeah, because you're hurt.
So I was real angry. Yeah, I was real angry. So, you know, my drinking went along with that. So, that took me down a really screwed up path of, like, crime and drug addiction. A complete mess for the rest of my 20s, like all the way through the rest of my 20s.
Just trying to fill that hole of grief with something.
Yeah, and it turned into, you know, drugs, alcohol, the adrenaline of being, you know, on the law and doing what we were doing there. It was, you know, everything, and it was just more, you know, like, I always tell people, they're like, what was your favorite drug? And I was like, more.
Yeah.
Yeah, more was my favorite everything. So, you know, more girls, you know, more girls, more sex, more drugs, more rock and roll, more crime, more whatever, you know?
Yeah, but less reality.
Oh, no, yeah, reality was, in that world, it was, and what catered to all that was, in that world, you had to put on personas, right? And it was what I was used to, the bad boy. And then it was like elevated, right? Like, so then I'm like literally playing parts. I'm you know, actually using fake names and, you know, living in different places and pretending to be people that I'm not. On top of the fact that even when I was being myself, I was pretending to be somebody I'm not, you know?
Right.
And so... You know, by the time I hit my 30s, I was so lost. I didn't even know who the hell I was. For real, I almost didn't know who I was. Like, yeah. You know, I thought I was losing my mind. I was so coked out and so strung out on dope. Had been through the ringer, up and down, in and out with everything else, with the other stuff that we were doing illegally, that just kept, you know, fueling the fire. That,
right.
You know, that was where I got to the point where I, you know, when I was in my early 30s, where when my, you know, my daughter's mom said they were moving, I was like, I've got to move or I'm going to die. You know, like, I'm going to either my body's going to give out or I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah.
It's one of the two. And so that was the reason I packed up and moved off to Tampa, you know, to just try to, I thought, you know, if I moved, I'd get all the problems from Dallas, right? So if I leave, then, you know, I'll stay there.
A geographical cure.
Yeah, geographical cure comes in. I landed in Tampa, and guess who was there?
me.
So, didn't work.
But how do you clean up in Tampa?
Yeah, that's what, you know. I love it. I love when I tell people, like, there's no place I don't know that's better or worse, right? Like, it's like ideal, because it's either going to kill you or cure you out here. There's no in between.
Yeah.
And it was, for me, the big part out here was, too, I was out of all my safety nets. You know, in Dallas, I had every type of safety net. And, you know, whether it was friends or cops or whoever, you know, that could get me out of whatever I got into, lawyers, whatever it was. And by the time I got to Tampa, I had no money, no friends, no family, nothing, you know. And very quickly fell out with my daughter's mom. So that was not going to be the person that was going to dig me out of a hole, right? And
right.
So I didn't have all those lifelines out here. So it was, I ended up finally getting arrested for one was an assault, and then I broke the probation on the assault because I was drunk and got into a DUI.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it progressed. And then, so there I sat, like, you know, June 6th, 2007. I made like a whole 6 months out here before I got arrested the first time.
Yeah.
And then the second time was about 4 or 5 months after that. But the issue I was looking at was I didn't have any money, didn't have any resources. I was locked up, and I was off, I violated a suspended sentence. So I was going to prison. So I was like, here we go. You know, white boy middle class America has finally hit rock bottom.
Yeah.
You know, he's in a place he can't get out of.
Let's go to prison. Yeah,
let's go. And the day that I got the DUI, I was trying to kill myself. I'd taken a bunch of pills, was drinking, and the idea was I wasn't going to come back out of it. And somehow, you know, you can talk to different people and whatever they believe, but I made it, right?
Yeah.
And so I woke up in jail and was still kind of out of it, tried to kill myself again in jail. So they locked me up in solitary because they were like, I was trying to slit my wrist with a fan cord blade, you know, the things with the prongs from from the fan. And, you know, so the sheriffs had to lock me up and put me in a solitary for, you know, a couple of days till I really got, you know, came to, you know, had me checked out and all that kind of stuff. And so then, that was when I was like, I don't want to do this anymore, man. I don't want to be like this. And so, you know, I made a decision there in the Pinellas County Jail to, you know, try to figure things out and work on things a little bit different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there were probably some clues in front of you that what you had been doing up to that point wasn't really panning out.
Yeah, there were a lot. I don't know if I even call them clues, more like just facts. Yeah, when you're sitting there staring at, you know, sitting on a floor sled bed, you know, and
yeah,
you know, eating the food they give you in that thing is just, you know, I'm sure some people can stay delusional for some whatever reason. I woke up that morning and I was no longer delusional about the reality of what I'd created.
Well, it's a lot harder to stay delusional when you sober up.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, you can do it. Plenty of people do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're not necessarily a delusional person in the first place, see, the whole issue, it sounds like from what I'm hearing is that, you know, the drugs and the alcohol and the behavior, all of it was a way of avoiding a reality that you knew would be waiting for you if you had to sit and think about it.
Yeah.
Did you handle silence very well at that point?
Oh, well, when I, we're talking about at that point when I cleaned up, when I sobered up.
Well, I mean, actually, yeah. Tell me about before and after. How did you handle silence when you were still?
Yeah. When I was active, there was no silence. It was drink or use until you pass out.
Yeah.
Because there really wasn't silence. That's the thing, was anytime it got quiet, the voice inside my head and the pain were so loud that I had to drown it out with something.
Yes.
So, yeah. So it was, there was no silence. There was no peace. So, and then of course, then you go do more dumb shit, right? So then finally you try to sober up. Then you remember the dumb shit you've done, and you have more guilt, shame, and all that stuff to pile on top of the pain that's right there.
Yeah. So, and then you still can't sit with the silence.
Yeah, it's like compounded interest on this stuff, right? Like, you got yourself into a credit card with a crappy interest rate.
Yeah.
You can't get out of it.
Yeah. But how did you start your path forward at that point? I mean, other than clumsily.
Yeah, it was. It really was. Pretty amazing, to be honest with you. Like, I hadn't read a book or anything in, you know, since I was in like high school, right? And I don't even know if I read one then. I probably, you know, paid somebody to do it or something.
Right.
And so I kind of went back to my religious upbringing, which was in Christianity. And being when you're in jail, they'll give you Bibles and stuff, right? Like, here you go, they'll give you that and AA books.
Yeah.
And I'll write it. So I was like, well, I've never been. The only time I've been to AA meetings was when it was court ordered, so I didn't really listen.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
and so they had them in there, and in the jail, if you did the AA meeting, you could like get out of the cell for a minute and go down the hallway. So I was like, I'll go to these because I got the book. And I read a couple things, and I was like, piqued my interest. Like, this is some like hit home. Like, I read a story about a guy, and he sounded like me, like the way he thought and what he struggled with. I was like, this is weird because I always thought I was just uniquely screwed up. Like, I was like, nobody could be this broken. Right.
Yeah.
And I started reading stuff. I was like, hey, this is crazy. These people, like, they think like I think. Like, it's kind of weird. So went to a meeting, enjoyed that. The other thing with me was I started reading the Bible, and I was like, it was really odd because what I do remember about reading it was, this is not the same book they taught me about
yeah.
when I was in church growing up. I was like, this is not, you know, mean. It was like, this guy's pretty good. Like, you know, this Jesus guy kind of nice to people, and he treats people pretty nice, you
right.
know?
Yeah.
And so I kind of started with some real basic stuff that was so foreign to me, which was like, I'd read, I'd journal, I'd try, you know, write about things myself, and like, I had been so selfish and self-absorbed that, like, little stuff like, you know, give. So I was like, I'd get canteen to get, like, cookies and stuff because my girlfriend at that point in time, who was not really my girlfriend anymore because of all that happened, but she was at least, like, putting $20 in my thing and trying to help me out.
Yeah.
You know, I would, like, give half my stuff away to people that didn't have anything and help people read that couldn't read and, you know, pray, you know, and not like, oh, God, save me and help me, just, you know, talking to myself and to whatever was out there, you know. And it started to calm down. Like, it just, I remember immediately, this is the part that I'm like, I, for me, it was a miracle. I laid down one of the first nights I was there, and I was just like, had a conversation with myself and God, and I was like, I don't want to be like this anymore. Like, I'm done. I'm tapping out. Like, this was an MMA fight. I'm tapping, right?
Yeah.
And I woke up the next day and something was different. You know, but immediately something was different. Like, everything wasn't fixed, and I wasn't like, I didn't know anything else. I wasn't smarter. But it was immediate, like, a sense of peace of, like, all right, this rat race chaos shit that I've been dealing with, like, it's done. I don't have to, I'm just done. I'm stopping. And,
yeah.
And we've got to start moving in another direction. So there was a large amount of relief. You know, and then I was able to kind of start, like I said, I'd read. And what I know now is, you know, it was some meditation at the time. I didn't know what the hell it was. You know, I just kind of lay and calm myself, you know?
Right, right.
And I just fell into some stuff. And I was like reading and writing the whole time I was there. And I was fortunate enough to be locked up for like 90 days straight first, right? Which is,
right, yeah.
In the grand scheme of things, not that long, but it was extremely important for me because I had never been held in one spot that long in my entire life.
Yeah, and it's enough time to shake you.
Yeah, it was enough time to rattle my cage, and it allowed me to, like, see some things that the universe aligned for me, you know, and, like, when I would really put something out there, I'd get a letter or I'd get a book or I'd get something, like, it's just weird shit. You know, like, this stuff would show up, like, you can't really explain it. And so it causes you to think and be like, how much stuff have I really missed in my life? It's really been laid out there for me to grab onto that, you know, maybe I just missed it because I was either so intoxicated or so resistant to reality.
Yeah.
That I just didn't even allow myself to participate in.
Yeah.
And then, like, being adherent to rules in jail was something new. So, but I saw, like, when you adhere and you, like, do what you're supposed to do, like, people leave you alone. Like, nobody bothers you.
Yeah.
It's kind of the opposite of what I thought. So that taught me some stuff too. And so, like I said, I was there for about 3 months and then was fortunate enough to not go to prison, to actually get to go to a drug treatment program. It was a 6-month in-house drug treatment program that was court ordered. And so I was able to go there and then spend another 6 months. So all in all, it ended up being, like, you know, almost a year, you know,
yeah,
of really focusing and working on my own mindset, mind, beliefs, all that stuff. And
right.
For whatever reason, I took really great notes of myself. And I look back now, it's kind of comical looking at some of the stuff I did. But, you know, as you learn along the way, at least I believe, I couldn't absorb everything at once. It was too much, you know, so you kind of stair-step it.
But oh, yeah.
As I worked through the process, things just kept getting better, and life just kept, you know, showing up differently than what I had originally convinced myself it would. And, you know, and you just keep expanding. So it was pretty remarkable. And it got me really addicted into, you know, exploring my own, you know, self-improvement. That was, like, kind of something I got. Well, I got addicted to that for a little bit.
Yeah.
So I mean, like, back
once you have an addictive personality, you're going to fill that hole with something.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's been an exciting journey over the last, you know, 12, 13 years or whatever it is, 12 years.
Yeah, because especially when you're trying to get clean from serious substance abuse, it does kind of force you to take a look at the big picture, not just the substance abuse.
Yeah, and that was the thing. I was like, you know, it's, well, and the other thing with me was when I did this, I was like, listen, talking to myself, you know, like, if I do this, I don't just want to be a guy who gets, like, sober or clean.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm going to put the work in, I'm going to put all the work in, and I want to have it. I want to have a good, happy life.
Yeah. You know? Otherwise, and, what's the fucking point?
Exactly. And that was my thing. I was like, because I did go, at that point in time, I'd gone to enough meetings to see, like, there are some people that are happy, and there are some people that are not.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, I don't want to be like that guy. He goes to a million meetings a day, and he does it, and he's miserable, and he's still one, you know, little thin goat hair away from relapsing all the time, because he's, like, still angry, still bitter, he's still resentful, but he goes to meetings every day. And God bless him. There's people out there like that. I'm not dogging them out. Yeah. I just, when I looked at it, I said, I don't want to be, I don't want to feel like that.
Right.
So I want to do whatever I've got to do to get myself into a position where I feel good about life, you know, more often than not.
And so where is your relationship with your kid at this point?
So when I got out, while I was locked up, there was no relationship. So, you know, I didn't see her. Her mom wasn't going to bring her down, and I asked her not to. You know, I was like, yeah. I don't want her to see this. And she was little at the time. She was only 5 or 6. She wasn't very old.
Right.
And so, you know, we kept them separate. When I got out, what we ended up doing was kind of, you know, I had to earn my way back in, right? Like, I mean, I realized that going back in, like, you know, my ex is not going to just come drop her off with me and be like, okay, cool, you know, now you're good. And on top of that, when I got out, I still didn't have any money or anything. The first place I moved into, I rented a boarded up laundry room in the Spanish neighborhood down by this office building that I was working in. It's like a walk to work, but it was like my bed was 2 cinder blocks and a piece of plywood. And I had one burner stove, and like if you went to put your shirt on, you're going to slam your elbow into the other wall. I mean, it was that small. So I was like, I didn't want her over there. I didn't have a car, couldn't drive.
Right. There's nothing worse than sad dad's new place.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. no matter what age you are, that place sucks.
Yeah.
So I mean, I was happy because I was free. You know, I had a second shot at life, but. So we kind of gradually worked that relationship back in. It took a little bit of time, but, you know, I'm actually, this week, we're, all of us are going, my wife, which is actually my girlfriend, I was telling you about, we ended up getting married later on. She stuck around, she stuck it out with me.
That's great.
And, we've been married for 10 years this year, so.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we have 3 little kids, like I said, and then I've got my oldest daughter. So we're all her mother and her new husband. They've been married 10 years too, just recently. So the 4 of us are taking her down. She's starting college this week, so we're driving her down to move her in her dorm and all that kind of stuff. So very cool. But you know, it's progressed from, you know, a really sick situation to one of the healthiest blended family situations I've ever even read about, you know,
yeah.
Because all the work that we've done, we co-parented our way all the way to high school in a way that baffles people at times.
Well, and it takes an effort. I mean, that's, I'm actually finally able to be friends with my ex as well. You know, we get along really great. And after a certain point, you have to recognize that, you know, whatever it was you were to each other, you're not that now. Now, you're in service of these little people who are waiting for you to get over your shit and figure it out.
Yep.
And it's rewarding. It's really rewarding to be able to, you know that your kid's got a couple of sets of parents.
Yeah, that love them and care. And, you know, it's one of those things. It's like a lot of things in life. It's like you can make it whatever you want, and you will. And so... that's good to hear that you guys are doing the same thing, because I wish it was more common, because I look at my little girl's upbringing and look, she hasn't missed out on anything. It's not weird. She's, you know, extremely mentally healthy, you know, to the point where it's like I'm like, dude, are you sure you're mine? other than she looks like me a little bit, but you know, it can be done, right?
Yeah, like it absolutely said,
it takes focus, work, and a willingness to put yourself aside and put the greater good of the group, you know, in front of it.
So tell me a little bit about where you are now as far as your your ability to take everything that you've gone through here and translate that into help for others.
Yeah. So I just look at life as an adventure now. And like, so everything's kind of a next, I look back and I was like, that's where I was at then. This is where I'm at now. Who knows where it's going to go. Where I'm at today is I do a good amount of like life coaching, and corporate consulting, business coaching, along with the fact that I own my own business too. I just started this last year, but, so that's been the gist that I work with people of all walks of life and income and, everything else on, I just got done writing a new program that we're going to be launching soon. It's called the 3D Life Experience, but it's about how to help people figure out who they are, what they want, and how to get there. And that's in a number of different, you know, any walk of life. And so people are different phases with that. And so, I've tried to compile everything that I've learned over the last 12 years and leverage that in each interaction I have with people to help people find what it is they need and what they want.
Yeah. How are you at having conversations about mental health with your kids now?
Very open. We talk, and so, you know, with my oldest, it's obviously different. She's almost 19. So we've had conversations with her over the last years. Her mother actually ended up going back to school and becoming a psychotherapist. So she and I have great banter back and forth too, stuff, because it's kind of fun. But so that's open. My wife's always been involved with what I do and the process that I've been in with, whether it was in the church early on or whether it's been in, you know, the what I call the regular secular world, or whatever you want to call it, like the regular world now. And so she and I have long talks about that. We've always been involved with, you know, helping people and talking to people. So my kids have grown up kind of around that. The little ones are, and they're, you know, the oldest one's 7. And so they, you know, there's regular conversations around that. We try to create a lot of awareness about that and talk about how to express ourselves openly and how you feel. And for me, it's about trying to create a really authentic environment for them to grow up in, to be themselves, to communicate who they are, how they feel, and you know, be that sounding board or that encourager or that director or whatever I need to be in the moment for them to help them get the most out of whatever phase they're in.
Well, I mean, that definitely sounds like the right way to approach it, because they'll have tools that are far surpassing anything that you could have hoped for at that age when you grew up with the situation you were in.
Yeah, I hope so. And we, you know, it's uncharted territory for me, like every day is. And so it's exciting, right? Like, so it's not like I'm even repeating anything. It's like, I don't know. And that's what, you know, like it's fun as a parent. Like, I think one of the coolest things, one of my mentors taught me early on. He was really a guy named Pastor David Towner. This guy like taught me so much, especially about relationships, about life. But he taught me about parenting early on, and it's like one of the most powerful things you can do with your children when you screw up is sit down, tell them what you did, and apologize if you need to, but explain to them the situation. Like, talk to them like they're a person, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's been so cool. At times is like, cause I mean, I screw up every day, you know, is to have that freedom, you know, to have the freedom within this environment we have here at home to be like, hey man, that was, you know, that's dad's fault. That's my fault, man. I shouldn't have said that. Or I shouldn't have did that. Here's why. And here's what was going through my head. And you know, like why I responded the way I did. And so my hope with that is like when they grow up, there's just that they just communicate that way. That authentic flow just kind of comes out like, hey, oh, my bad, I owned it. Here's why I did that. Here's the thought process that was behind it. And, you know, now I can learn from it and hopefully not do that again.
For sure. Well, I mean, think about all of the negatives that come along with trying to, just trying to take a mistake or a failure and put it under the rug rather than addressing it and owning it. All of the stuff that comes with that, you know, the shame, the feeling like you know you're unworthy of people's love and attention because you made this mistake, and people don't make mistakes, and mistakes are bad, and you know just all of the negative stuff that comes with trying to avoid owning something that you did.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's detrimental to you at any stage in life, and you know, especially when you get up, get in the working world. I mean, that's doing the corporate stuff I do. That's probably one of the biggest problems I face in companies is just they don't have the environment where people can be like, man, that was my fault. I did that.
Yeah.
You know, or they don't try anything because they're scared what's going to happen if it ends up being their fault, right? So then they have a culture of just frozen figures, and you know, it's a dead mindset. So yeah, I hope they see and catch on to that. They seem to be so far. So you know, we'll keep plugging along.
Yeah, that's the best you can hope for some days, right?
Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking to me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is exciting. I love getting to share and talk about, you know, my life and the crazy stuff that's happened. And hopefully, like I said, I do it because I hope somebody's listening and they can relate and they can take something from it that encourages them or changes their life in some way. So I'm sure that's one of the main reasons you do your show, too, just to get information out there to help people, right?
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, too.
And there it is. This guy was really fantastic. If you want to find out more about Eric Sims, and I know you do, get yourself over to IamEricSims.com. And guess what? Eric can also be found on the Twitter and on the Instagram as IamEricSims. If you want to know what I'm doing next, I have got a show coming up October 21st at the Buntport Theater Company in Denver, Colorado. It's the We Still Like You show, Denver edition, where I'll be telling a story about personal shame. And you're not going to want to miss this one if you're in the area, because it is a doozy, and it will not be on this podcast. But until next time, don't kill yourselves out there.